Hello, and welcome to this week's Key Voices, conversations with folk in and around education. I'm Caroline Doherty. This week, I'm talking to Simon Knight, who is joint head teacher at Frank Wise School. I loved talking to Simon. He is full of energy and passion for his work and his school. It was really interesting to hear him describe himself as a guardian of the school. I really like that idea. And to hear how actually the curriculum has evolved over a 30-year period as well, when we think about how much chopping and changing it sometimes feels like there can be in education. It was also good to hear him talk about the pandemic and how actually the community is so strong around the school that although it was challenging, they actually managed to provide a really high quality offer for the young people. But this podcast is a difficult listen, and it is really challenging to hear how things that many of us take for granted, such as employment, relationships, and a relatively long life, are just not necessarily available to many young people with SEND. And Simon and I talk about an Institute of Health Equity report, A Fair and Supportive Society, in quite a bit of detail on that topic. And he really does challenge us to think about how we can move away from ambivalence on some of these issues to take some really practical action so that everybody feels included in society. As ever, I'd just like to remind listeners that this podcast is an opportunity to open up debate and discussion around topics. The views my guests and I are about to express are not the view of the Key. For in-depth authoritative articles on the latest issues in education, check out thekeysupport.com. Hello, today I'm joined by Simon Knight, who is joint head teacher at Frank Wise School. Hello, Simon, how are you?
Morning, Caroline. Yeah, I'm good, cheers, thank you. Good.
Well, thanks for making time for talking to us today. Can you tell us a bit about your background and your school? If helpful, talk about what it's like in sort of normal times, if we can remember them.
Yes, gosh. Well, so we're coming up to almost a year now, aren't we, at this disruption and this period of turbulence. And I have to say, from an education point of view, it's been an interesting experience, but particularly from a special schools point of view, and we'll probably touch a little bit on that, you know, as we go through the questions. So my background, I've worked in the sector for over 20 years now, and interestingly, ended up in special education, partly because as a fairly lazy 13-year-old, I couldn't be bothered to walk home from school. And back then, which would have been sort of 1980s, my mum worked here as a teaching assistant. And my school finished about 30 minutes before Frank Wise did. And it was a lot quicker for me to walk down to Frank Wise School and sit in reception and wait for her to finish work and then get a lift home than it was for me to walk all the way home back in those days. And, you know, obviously we wouldn't be able to do things like that now. We wouldn't have random members of staff's children sat in reception, not without DBS checking them and all those sorts of things as well, I'm sure. But back then, you know, that was perfectly normal. And I just became, sort of just really interested in the personalities, the people, the community, as these young people would be, you know, walking past, getting ready to get on the bus to go home or being picked up by their families. And over time, you got to know some of them and they'd stop and have a chat. And it was a really interesting way of breaking down some of those perceptual barriers around difference and disability. And it was never intentional. So I ended up going to university, slightly delayed because I wasn't the most attentive of students during my A-levels and ended up being asked to repeat a year, mainly through non-attendance rather than any kind of misbehaviour. And then after university, I did English and philosophy. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And the head teacher at the time, an amazing man called Kevin Griffiths, who really laid the foundations of what Frank Wise is today, basically said, why don't you come and be a TA for a year while you're thinking about what you want to do? So I did. And then by the end of September, so only a month into the job, I'd applied for teacher training and managed to get on a course at Warwick. So I went off and did that. and never looked back. It was very clear to me very, very quickly that I didn't want to work in mainstream. I think that was partly the impact of the National Literacy Strategy, is that my teacher education was very much about how to implement this strategy that had been thought about and constructed and developed by other people. And I wanted a job that forced me to think every day about how I was going to overcome barriers to learning and how I was going to think about how to deliver things differently and develop things that didn't exist commercially. And special ed gave me that opportunity. So yeah, back in 98, started as a teacher, absolutely clueless. As a teacher, probably not much less clueless now, to be honest, because the kids present us with all sorts of interesting challenges. And one of the great things about working in the sector is that, you know, never a day goes by without you being wrong about something. You know, you just try to make sure it's not the critical things, but certainly from a developmental point of view, you know, kids learn things you wouldn't have expected them to and don't learn things you would have thought would have been fairly straightforward. And so that's me, 20 odd years in the sector, do a fair amount of stuff beyond the school, little bits and pieces at a national level. I help, you know, help out with Whole School Send, which is quite a big DfE contract, and often get asked, you know, my thoughts about SEN. So it's quite nice to have another opportunity to talk about it.
Great stuff. And as you mentioned, you've been at your school one way and another for a really long time. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so we're a fairly standard community special school in many ways, and then in other ways we are extraordinarily unique and different. So we're a 2-19 special school. The children that we work with are defined as you know, SLD, PMLD, which is severe learning disabilities or profound and multiple learning disabilities. We're really not into labels though. You know, the kids already come with a label, it's generally their name, and we don't need much more than that. We need to know who they are as individuals and who they are as people, and you know, what their families think and that kind of stuff. So as a school, we have a very clear view on that. We don't go down the route of, you know, interventions that are based around a particular diagnosis. We'll only group our kids by age, so we don't segregate children further, you know, by their diagnoses or their disabilities or by presumptions that adults make about what they're capable of. You know, our guys are already segregated from the mainstream. Why would we want to segregate them further? So we have really clear social groups, and these kids grow up together. You know, some of them will be here 17 years, and, you know, they spend a lot of their lifetime, you know, in each other's company at school, you know, 6 hours a day, 39 weeks a year. It's quite a chunk, and the families get to know one another, and we feel that it creates a more dynamic, you know, more sort of person-centered, you know, environment in which to learn, you know, rather than an environment that's maybe characterized around, you know, presumptions about certain disabilities or whatever. As I said earlier, the kids confound us all the time. It's one of the great joys of working in the sector, is they make us think, and that's one of the things that we want to invest our time in, is thinking. So we spend a lot of time developing stuff here. We have our own assessment materials that we've written because we couldn't find things commercially that would meet the needs of the children we work with. We devote a huge amount of time to curriculum, and we're exceptionally proud of the curriculum that we've developed. So, you know, I'm fortunate, you know, we consider ourselves really to be custodians of this school, and we don't talk about my school, you know, it's always our school, it's the community's school, and we just happen to be the people that are helping navigate it, you know, through this period of time at the moment and hopefully for further years in the future. But our curriculum's like 30 years old. It's a continually evolving, you know, piece of work, and you know, that sense of intellectualism and a thirst for improvement and a thirst for understanding is what really drives the school. You know, it's not a school that places, you know, kind of superficial experiences at the heart of what it does. You know, this is about robust, evidence-informed education with the intention of changing lives. Now, we make it sparkly because that's fun, but underneath that is a real determination that this is a meaningful, purposeful, and impactful place to be educated. And that's really important to us.
And as you say, having so much of a young person's childhood, really, in your that you're guardians of, that is a huge responsibility, one you clearly take very seriously, and as you say, the ability to sort of work on and refine something over so many years, and particularly your long experience in the school. as we alluded to, and we can't really escape from, we are in a period of much turbulence and change right now. What has your experience of the pandemic been like?
Conflicted, I think it's probably fair to say. It's been brutal. I've never experienced anything like this in my career in terms of the intensity of you know, speed of thought, emotional demands, holding a community together as best you possibly can whilst not really knowing the answers to the questions that you're being asked. But at the same time, what's been really clear throughout all of this is the strength of the community that we work within and work for. You know, the staff here are absolutely extraordinary, and the families that we serve and the children that we serve have been absolutely incredible. So it is that strange conflict, really. And I suspect at some point in the future, there'll be an awful lot of value in sitting down and quite carefully reflecting on this process. It's very different at the moment, I have to say. If we go back to the beginning, you know, that sort of got almost a year ago now. I just find that extraordinary. Mm-hmm. You know, so a year ago, you're kind of hearing these stories, you're kind of getting a sense that there's something going on. And as you got through February and into the beginning of March, you know, the sort of the momentum's building around something that you think, God, okay, there's something happening here. You know, we need to be prepared for this. And I still remember, you know, sort of mid-March, we had kids going out on residential. You know, it's like we went on a residential trip, I remember going with one of the groups, having a wonderful time. And then literally over a weekend, almost having to pull the plug on everything because it became clear that this was no longer safe to do so. And, you know, we were talking about numbers like, you know, they'd had 23 cases in an area that we were going to. And now we're talking hundreds per day in our own town. You know, it is an extraordinary shift. But back in the beginning, we made a decision really, really early on to act with clarity and be decisive, that we thought the most important thing was to be absolutely clear to people about why we were doing what we were doing and to act as fast as was sensible and responsible to do so. And part of that came from a piece that I saw. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he works for the World Health Organization and was talking about the need for speed of thought. Because if you ponder too much, it's changed. And the decision that you would have made is no longer the decision that needs to be made. And so we kind of got everyone together back in the days when we had face-to-face staff meetings rather than always meeting on Zoom, which is what we do now, and said, look, you know, we're going to make mistakes here. You know, what we're going to try and make sure is that we do things in the best interest of the community of the school, that we do things that create a safe environment in which to be. But please don't expect us to get this right, because we've never done this before, any of us, you know. But what we will do is we'll act clearly, we'll act quickly, and then we'll reflect afterwards if things need to be adjusted. And we acted very conservatively. So we moved fast, put things in that we felt were sensible protections, acting on the best available evidence at the time. And actually that steadied us. You know, that's put us in a good place, because the protective kind of behaviours that we've been advised to do, we'd actually kind of taken on board fairly early on. I think as special schools, we're fairly good at understanding hygiene routines and protective kind of routines around clinical behaviours and stuff like that. So, you know, we have PPE because we provide intimate care for children. So, you know, we had to add in, you know, the fluid resistant face masks. That was a bit different. But we already had gloves, we already had aprons, we already had hand gels and stuff like that. So it was really an escalation of our own behaviours rather than a complete sea change. It feels a bit different now. We've definitely moved from a position of intuitive leadership to one of more rational leadership. And I think we're kind of settled in now for the probably medium term, at least, hopefully not the long term, and trying to better understand, you know, how we can try and minimise the impact this is going to have on people's education. And that's a very different conversation to the one that's happening in the mainstream in terms of, you know, disadvantage and the widening of gaps and stuff like that. For our guys, there is no closing of the gap. There is no catch up. Their education is lost to them, you know, because their education is personal, it's bespoke, it's individual. We're not comparing them to their peers in the same chronologically determined way that you would have in mainstream. You know, I'm not going to try and enable them to get to a certain point, because that point wouldn't have been reached until they reached it anyway. Mm. So what we're concerned about is the fact that for some of them, they've essentially lost or had disrupted best part of a year's education. And I think government and the sector have got to give some really careful thoughts about how we minimise the impact of that.
And we were talking just before we started recording a little bit about where you are now in terms of the number of children attending and also the remote provision that you have in place. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, again, the nature of the sector and the nature of the requirements of the children that attend schools like ours means that, you know, that there are some interesting challenges that we face. The biggest one, and I remember we were sat in the staff room after school watching the government's announcements around education. And when they made the statement that every child with an education, health and care plan would be entitled to attend school face to face, you could just see people's jaws drop in the realisation that, that's 100% of our population. You know, that's 98% of the special schools population. You know, this is, they're basically saying that schools have got to shut down, but not you. And that's been kind of, I suppose, one of the bugbears throughout all of this is that we've been treated quite differently, but without necessarily always having an evidence base to justify why that's safe to do so. So we've had to be pragmatic and we've had to kind of make decisions that we feel are, you know, morally appropriate, whilst also trying to stay within the expectations of guidance and with legislation. Because the bottom line is that currently, the protections that the child's education has within the context of the Children's and Families Act and the protections that staff have within the context of the Health and Safety at Work Act, they're not particularly happy bedfellows at the moment. You know, you can't completely meet one without impacting on the other. And so we've had to be really quite careful in terms of how we've interpreted, you know, our responsibilities under that. This is where the community bit came in, because we've had staff that have rolled their sleeves up and families that have worked in partnership with us really, really, very successfully. And I'm really proud. That's probably one of the things that I'm most proud of this whole thing. It's about how the community stood up to this. So this isn't about individuals. This isn't about people leading organisations. This is about communities coming together in the best interests of one another. So where are we at the moment? We've got over 50% of children in face-to-face education, not all full-time. We currently have every single family who would like their child to be in at some point during the week in. And we have a remote offer that is, you know, as best we can, meeting the objectives set out in the HCPs and the priorities set out in the individual education plans. But it's not a remote offer like you would have in a mainstream school. So, you know, it's not sit at a table and do a Google lesson or, you know, watch Oaks and study through that. Although I have to say some of the Oaks stuff for the special schools is really, really very good. And we are using that as part of our offer. Because for us, our education is a physical, hands-on, tangible education. This is not an exchange of knowledge. It's sometimes an exchange of, you know, kind of physicality or emotion or socialisation. So we're also having to work with families to develop offers that provide therapeutic input, you know, and communicative input. We're really fortunate. Our local councillors have rallied around us a little bit as well. So we're just about to put together a therapeutic lending library that is being part funded by the district council, so that we can actually deploy therapeutic resources into the home in a bit more of a systematic way than we've been able to historically. We're not the best funded of schools. I'm sure every head teacher will take that, but you know, we generally are not a very well-funded school, so we don't have resourcing capacity to support the kids in school and those kids out of school at the same time. We're doing a bit better with tech now that DfE have kind of provided us with some bits there, but there's always been a bit of a gap in terms of understanding that remote education for special schools is not just about, you know, digitization. Mm-hmm. It is about making sure that we've got things like physio balls and, you know, standing ladders and, you know, kind of therapeutic sensory equipment in the home. So hopefully within the next couple of weeks we'll have that sorted and we'll have things that they can make use of in that way as well, in a much more effective way.
Great stuff, and good luck with that offer. We touched on a little bit there these concepts of equity and disadvantage, and I feel like throughout the course of the pandemic and obviously before, you know, there's a lot of discussion and dialogue in education about equity in education. And this is just really my personal perception and reflection is that that does tend to focus a lot on disadvantage. And, you know, that's obviously a very important thing. But the special education needs kind of do get left out of that conversation. I mean, maybe to your point that the gap won't be closed in that academic sense. But I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. The sort of the notion of disadvantage being almost exclusively socioeconomically determined is problematic when you work in a school like ours. A good example of that is how the pupil premium is constructed, is that, you know, we receive money on the basis of a child's socioeconomic status. But the primary barrier to learning, if you go to a school like this, is your learning disability. It's your cognitive or your physiological or sensory, you know, needs rather than your socioeconomic ones. And yet we're held accountable for that money in exactly the same way that a mainstream school is. And I remember having quite long conversations with civil servants about this right at the very beginning and saying, actually, from a socioeconomic point of view, the barriers aren't necessarily around acquiring knowledge. It's around the application of knowledge. So we can teach these kids almost anything. You know, we're really good at what we do. We really understand learning. The challenges that the families face more often is about enabling their child to access things within the community, within society, because quite often they're centralised services. You've got to have a car to be able to get to them or use public transport, or they cost money and they're not fully funded by social care. And that's where I'd really like to be able to invest some of that money. But we have to account for it in how we're enabling kids to make cognitive progress and ensuring that children with certain designations don't progress less than others. And it's an interesting one. I'm slightly sympathetic with DfE's position. They can't not provide us with that funding because that would be discriminatory. But what they could have done is had slightly more subtlety in the way that they held us accountable, because actually it hampers our ability to deploy that funding effectively, and sometimes results in, you know, in decisions being made that you might do differently if you had a bit more freedom. I'm not a great fan of hypothecation of funding in general. I have similar views around the PE money, and the COVID catch-up one was a fascinating one, because, you know, as I was saying earlier, catch up to what? Catch up to whom? You know, they're catching up to themselves, most of these kids. We just got to, you know, enable them to learn the next thing, learn more stuff. You know, so that those comparative, chronologically determined comparative measures are really not great for us, you know, and I think that's where we could do with a little bit more trust of the sector about how we spend money, because most of us are in this job to do the very best that we possibly can. So we're not going to be frivolous with it. We're not going to waste it on things. You know, we are going to try and make sure it maximises its impact. You know, and so let us do what's right for our communities rather than on the basis of a generalised policy.
I completely see how that could be really, really challenging to try and sort of divide up and allocate funding on that basis without looking, you know, at the children as individuals and in the round and in their communities, and particularly those kind of social needs as well. That's really interesting. And obviously we mentioned the government a few times, and we feels like we're sort of stuck in a bit of a holding pattern around the SEND review. Still waiting for that and any kind of policy change around it. But my understanding is that there is this kind of growing focus on outcomes for people, pupils with SEND. And that obviously began with more years of funding for a young person with an EHCP. What more do you think needs to be done to actually kind of fully realise this aspiration around kind of cross-departmental working and kind of lifetime outcomes for the sector?
Well, the most important thing is that government has got to enact the outcome of a review. I mean, it's like, it's becoming a bit like Lord of the Reviews, really, and hopefully this is the review to rule them all, because we've had a lot of reviews of SEND by different departmental, you know, bodies. Mm. But actually, what's actually happened? Very little has actually happened. I try to be, you know, relentlessly optimistic about these things, and I'm really hopeful that the SEND review, you know, as and when it's published, will create the foundation for change and the foundation for much needed reform. But you're right, that reform cannot be enacted by education alone. And, you know, it's interesting, you see this in the Education, Health and Care Plan structure, the Children and Families Act, is that education does a lot of the heavy lifting in there. You know, there's a lot of responsibility placed on education. Often the ownership administratively is with education. And health and social care are kind of, you know, they're bit parts, they're kind of, you know, extras within the system. And there needs to be much more equity in terms of where the responsibility sits and where the accountability sits. But in terms of having a real impact, of actually changing lives, of actually improving society and ensuring that everyone has a place within society where they, you know, can contribute and are valued, that again, it needs many sectors to come together. You know, social care has got to be involved in that. Department of Business has got to be involved in that. We need the private sector and the charitable sectors involved in that, because this needs to be a community-based response. You know, not one where we, you know, place a lot of pressure and invest a lot of money in education and then sit around surprised afterwards when we've still got an unemployment rate of, you know, mid-90s% for the learning disabled community. Yeah, that's unacceptable. If that was any other defined group within society, there'd be outrage. Mm-hmm. And yet the ambivalence towards the disabled community is something that should be shamed of in this country. We're awful at that. You know, I genuinely believe that, you know, disableism is the most socially acceptable of the isms that are left. You know, many others have been challenged quite vociferously, you know, through major national responses to, you know, the disadvantage that different groups feel and the abuse that they feel. But this is still a hidden issue in many ways. And when you look at the data around life opportunities of people, you know, with learning disabilities, it really is shocking. You know, so I am hopeful about the SEND review and hopeful that it will be a call to arms and, you know, something of a starting point of change. But at the same time, you know, we've seen this before and little has happened and there is little difference in terms of the lived experiences of families and their children.
Yeah, and it feels to me that there is something, as you say, about the wider society and aspiration for these young people and higher expectations of what happens beyond education. And, you know, not that I'm by any means an expert in these things, but it appears to me where you have these drop-off points and an end, be it leaving the care system, leaving, you know, prison or those sorts of things, where you stop being a particular part of the state's problem and that there isn't enough kind of transition or consideration of that, that is where often the problems come. And it's totally predictable. You know, because the government is sort of pulling the plug in one place and not doing anything to try and stop the water running away.
And absolutely. And often, you know, these complex, you know, multi-layered social challenges, you know, we sit around and pontificate on them as public servants, but we don't really embrace the evidence of the lived experience of the people it affects. And, you know, I think we need to be a little bit more, you know, honest about the limitations of our knowledge and our expertise and actually go back to find out from people who've been through these processes, who've actually encountered these barriers and have had their lives materially affected by them and ask them what needs to change. And, you know, there's a lot of superficiality around things like co-production and stuff like that. You know, still too often it's a public service paradigm where we bring in families afterwards to consult on the ideas that we've already come up with. And that's got to change. If you want real change to happen, you know, then what we need is people that are actually living this day to day to be driving the priorities for change, not just being brought on post hoc to tell us whether we've done it right or not. And that's a big shift. And that's a big shift that we need across the public sector. And until that really changes, I think we're going to be tiptoeing around the edges.
No, exactly. So that, you know, the voice of those people does not get heard. Certainly in these policymaking conversations, completely agree there. And we actually spoke a little bit about the work of Michael Marmot and his team at the Institute for Health Equity when we were arranging to record. And absolutely, I'm going to put a link to this document on the website, but there are some staggering and heartbreaking statistics in this report. And one is that people with learning disabilities on average die 15 to 20 years sooner than people in the general population, which I think will shock a lot of people when they hear that. And it's estimated that more than 1,200 children and adults with a learning disability die prematurely every year. And that means that their death rate is six times higher than the rest of the population on average, according to Public Health England. So you know, I found that absolutely astounding. Thank you for pointing me in the direction of that report. And it also talks about the relationship between having SEND and poor mental health, experiencing poverty, experiencing social isolation, unemployment, poor quality housing, and bullying. And all of those things do, as we said, just go way beyond the remit of education, of course, and they show the scale of the challenge. I think we focused on some of the negatives quite a bit. I'd really like to hear your thoughts about how we can actually build a truly inclusive society and one where, you know, in 20 years time we're not sharing these terrible statistics.
Yeah. Well, let's hope it's not in 20 years' time.
Well, I was just throwing a number out there. Let's make it sooner.
Well, we're already 40 years late. Yeah. So, was it Iris Warnock saying that she thought, I think it was, I might be wrong here, maybe it was 20 years, maybe it was 40 years, but about 40 years to get the system ready to be able to meet the educational requirements of all children in an inclusive manner. And we are a million miles away from that at the moment. The complexities here are significant. I mean, even if we just take trying to raise the complexity threshold in mainstream schools, the inputs that are required on this over time are really quite extraordinary. The starting point for me, from an educational point of view, is addressing the variance in initial teacher education inputs around SEND. Mm. There's still too much variability there, you know, and I'm not a great one for centralization in many ways or for kind of determining what people do. I think it's important that there's professional responsibility and professional freedom, but I do think there needs to be a move towards the quantification and specification of SEND input in ITE, because there are still cases where it isn't prioritized fully, and there are still times where trainee teachers are entering the classroom, you know, prepared in very, very different ways with very, very different levels of input, and yet they have a universal responsibility to the children that they teach, you know, the moment they walk through that classroom door. And that's not fair on the kids, and it's not fair on the adults either to put them in that position. And then building on that, you know, we've had some, I suppose, with the initial teacher education, you know, core content frameworks and opportunities to look at that. We've also got the early career framework, which has a nod towards SEND, but it's, you know, it's in a slightly different way. I think it's very open for interpretation. You know, we talk about adaptable teaching, and that's probably quite a nice way of conceptualizing it in some ways, as long as those delivering those programs understand the detail of what it is that needs to be delivered. And then you've got the same with the MPQs, you know, recently redeveloped, probably ought to declare an interest that I helped on one of them. And again, there's an opportunity here, but only if the implementation is done, you know, in a thoughtful and considered way. And that takes you through into, you know, sort of the leadership of schools and whose responsibility is it. There are still a huge number of issues around SEND in education. Too often we have like an abdication sandwich where, you know, teachers look to the Senko. Well, I don't know what to do. It's the Senko's responsibility to help me. And head teachers look to the Senko. It's, you know, it's the Senko's responsibility to deal with that. And actually, it's all our responsibilities. And, you know, it's really important that we embrace that and that we're honest about the areas we do least well and seek the opportunities to do them better. But we did a bit of research on this at Whole School Send in partnership with UCL, and looked at the demand and drivers around CPD, around SEND topics, and it is really poorly prioritised by schools, And part of that is to do with accountability structures, you know, is that there's an awful lot of attention drawn towards those things that create the greatest risk for schools. And at the moment, SEND still doesn't stand up there in a way that it really ought to, although, you know, Ofsted are clearly trying to make sure they reflect SEND related, you know, observations in their reports. I'd still say that even that now is still too variable in terms of the quality and depth of analysis about what schools are doing. And so you've got this kind of trajectory of change that needs to build from, you know, the most important resource that schools has, which is its teaching staff, you know, in terms of delivering content. You need to get it right for them and then build a continuum through their education as teachers, you know, in terms of their professional development, to ensure that they get access to high quality, you know, SEND related CPD throughout that. Because the complexity threshold in schools is dropping, you know, we're seeing an increased number of children, you know, being educated outside of the mainstream. And that's not right. I mean, you know, as a special school head, I am absolutely a strong advocate and a strong believer of the role that special schools have to play within a broadly inclusive education system. I'm not an abolitionist in terms of special schools. It has an important role for us. But what I would like to see is a diminishing need to use this over time. So more and more mainstream schools are able to meet the requirements of children with greater complexity in their schools, so that we become perhaps even more specialised than we are at the moment, you know, addressing those very particular requirements that children sometimes have. How that feeds into society is, you know, who knows? I mean, one of the things that we do here in normal times, fondly look back to a year ago, is that every single child here spends half a day a week in mainstream up to the age of 16. They have class-based partnerships with mainstream schools. We've got relationships with 11 different classes in 8 different schools, covering faith schools, academies, maintained primaries, independent sector, the lot. And then at 16, their curriculum is a community-based curriculum. They're in the local town all the time. Every day there are kids going out doing things that are educationally, kind of determined, but community, you know, delivered. And it's that visibility that's absolutely essential, you know, for us, and absolutely key to ensuring that our kids are not lost from sight of society. What I will say, and this is an uncomfortable, you know, admission, I'm not really convinced, despite everything that we do and how good we are, and we are good at what we do, that it has a truly materially, you know, long-term impact on children's lives. And we can go back to, you know, the Institute of Health Equity report, the Fair Supportive Society. There are barriers that exist beyond education that prevent the potential that we realised in partnership with families from being made use of. And that is that requires some proper soul searching by us as a society to resolve.
Yeah, and interestingly, sort of linking back to what you were saying about the voice of these young people as well, I was struck in reading the report about the high number of children with learning disabilities that similarly also have behaviour problems, emotional issues, mental health concerns, and again, no expertise, but you know, that must be linked to how they feel about being separated from society, or their interaction with society, and as you say, in some of those setups and situations. So I think that's really interesting to think about as well, how happy they are.
Yeah, it's painful to think about, you know, because actually sometimes we create these situations, we then pathologize them, and then present the solution and then celebrate the fact that we've done that. But as a society, we've created it. You know, it's there's something deeply uncomfortable about all of that, about the way we pathologize difference and separate difference. And, you know, you'd think that, you know, as we're in the 21st century, that things would have changed a bit. But then you're talking to someone who's older than the sector he works in. You know, special education's a little over 40 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got books in our school library that we refuse to throw away that talk about educating the educationally subnormal. They're not that old. You know, this is 1960s stuff. You know, and I think, you know, we need to make sure that we don't lose sight of the fact that we're still at the beginnings of, you know, a long journey. But it is slightly shameful that we're still at the beginnings of a long journey and that we haven't made the progress that perhaps we should have done as a society. And I think there are all sorts of complexities to that are quite difficult to articulate with clarity, you know, and you probably need a broader panel of families and young people and experts in other areas of you know, public service to be able to really get to grips with that, you know, but there's a real barrier here to us really embracing difference in British society in all sorts of different ways.
Indeed, a lot to think about there. And as you say, really interesting to reflect that, you know, it really wasn't that long ago where languages and approaches to special education were very different. So let's be hopeful and you know, there may well be a lot of learning from this. We can't quite distill it yet, but this last year and however long forward around bespoke education, remote families having more input, more meaningful input, perhaps, into co-production as a result of working with their young people at home. What do you think?
But there's definitely been some benefits to the pandemic. Feels slightly odd saying that. There's not been many, but there is some emerging evidence that some children have found the remoteness of remote learning hugely beneficial, and that's had a profound impact on their ability to complete the work that's being provided at a level that's more sophisticated. I think there's a lot to unpick there, and I wouldn't want to go into too much thought on it, because I just don't know enough about it or know whether or not it's a short-term, kind of benefit that would have some potential long-term disadvantages. But there is absolutely an opportunity here for reflection around the structures that we build around education and around the way that we approach it. I was having a conversation yesterday with somebody who's doing some work on post-pandemic education and what that might look like, and we came back to the fact that for so many of our children is the digitization of it is not necessarily going to be a solution because of the very physical nature of the education that we offer, the therapeutic aspects of it and the social kind of sense of what we do, however, are there opportunities for greater flexibility, for greater personalization, within perhaps the mainstream, which is delivering education on a much broader, much more grander scale, in terms of numbers, that there are adjustments here that maybe we wouldn't have previously considered to be reasonable. Mm. In fact, schools would have resisted making them on the basis they were unreasonable, but they've now made them for everybody. Mm. And therefore, let's use that learning, not just in terms of what works well, but also in terms perhaps of what actually is reasonable in terms of supporting those who need something slightly different to be able to access the mainstream. So I think, there'll be a time of reflection after this, and hopefully we can not discard the things that were successful as we try to move forward beyond what has been a most extraordinary period of time.
Indeed. And is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners in closing?
Oh, blimey. You said quite a lot. Maybe it's a bit too much. I think it's tricky, isn't it? You have these opportunities, you have these platforms, and you get the opportunity to say what you think. I think the most important thing is that, let's create a bit more space for people whose lived experiences can inform what we do, and stop making the presumption that those with the qualifications are best placed to make the decisions, because actually it's those that experience it day to day that can help us work together to come up with the best ways of taking things forward.
Wow, that was very elegantly put. Thank you so much, Simon. Really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy day to talk to us. And thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Members of The Key for School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com. And please tell us what you think of the podcast. Rate, review and subscribe, or email me at caroline.doherty@thekeysupport.com with your thoughts and suggestions.